Chasing the ravens, Patricia forgot to look down until she collided with someone. She felt the impact and heard the yelp of distress before she saw whom she'd run over, a gangly boy with sandy hair and an oversized chin who'd fallen against the chicken wire fence at the playground's edge and rebounded onto the grass. He pulled himself upright.
"Why the hell don't you look where you're..."
He glanced at something on his left wrist that wasn't a watch, and cursed way too loud.
"What is it?" Patricia said. "You broke my time machine."
He yanked it off his wrist and showed her.
"You're Larry, right?"
Patricia looked at the device, which was definitely broken. There was a jagged crack in its casing, and a sour odor coming from inside it.
"I'm really sorry about your thing. Can you get another? I can totally pay for it. Or my parents can, I guess."
She was thinking that her mom would love that. Another disaster to make up for.
"Buy another time machine?"
Larry snorted. "You're going to, what, just walk down to Best Buy and get a time machine off the rack?" He had a faint scent of cranberries, maybe from some body spray or something.
"Don't be sarcastic," Patricia said. "Sarcasm is for feeble people."
She hadn't meant that to rhyme. Plus, it had sounded more profound in her head.
"Sorry."
He squinted at the wreckage, then carefully unpeeled the strap from his bony wrist. "It can be repaired, I guess. I'm Lawrence, by the way. Nobody calls me Larry."
"Patricia."
Lawrence held out his hand, and she hoisted it three times.
"So was that actually a time machine?"
she asked.
"You're not joking or whatever?"
"Yeah, sort of. It wasn't that great. I was going to toss it out soon in any case. It was supposed to help me escape from all this. But instead, all it did was turn me into a one-trick pony."
"Better than being a no-trick pony."
Patricia looked up again at the sky. The ravens were long gone, and all she saw was a single, slowly disintegrating cloud. After that, Patricia saw Lawrence around. He was in some of Patricia's classes. She noticed that Lawrence had fresh poison ivy scars on both skinny arms and a red bite on his ankle that he kept raising his pant leg to inspect during English class. His knapsack had a compass and map spilling out of the front pouches, and grass and dirt stains along its underside. A few days after she wrecked his time machine, she saw Lawrence sitting after school on the back steps near the big slope, hunched over a brochure for a great outdoors adventure weekend. She couldn't even imagine. 2 whole days away from people and their garbage. 2 days of feeling the sun on her face. Patricia stole into the woods behind the spice house every chance she got, but her parents would never let her spend a whole weekend.
"That looks amazing," she said,
and Lawrence twitched as he realized she was looking over his shoulder.
"It's my worst nightmare," he said, "except it's real."
"You've already gone on one of these?" Lawrence didn't respond, except to point to a blurry photo on the back of the leaflet, in which a group of kids hoisted backpacks next to a waterfall, putting on smiles except for one gloomy presence in the rear. Lawrence, wearing a ridiculous round green hat, like a sport fisherman's. The photographer had captured Lawrence in the middle of spitting out something.
"But that's awesome," Patricia said.
Lawrence got up and walked back into the school, shoes scuffing the floor.
"Please," Patricia said. I wish I had someone to talk to about stuff. Even if nobody can ever understand the things I've seen, I would settle for just knowing someone else who is close to nature."
"Wait, don't walk away. Lawrence!" He turned around.
"You got my name right."
His eyes narrowed.
"Of course I did. You told it to me."
"Huh." He rolled that around in his mouth for a moment.
So what's so great about nature?
It's real. It's messy. It's not like people.
She talked to Lawrence about the congregations of wild turkeys in her backyard and the vines that clung to the walls of the graveyard down the road, Concord grapes, all the sweeter for their proximity to the dead. The woods near here are full of deer, and even a few elk, and the deer have almost no predators left. A fully grown buck can be the size of a horse.
Lawrence looked horrified at that idea.
You're not really selling it, Lawrence said.
So, you're outdoorsy, huh?
Patricia nodded. Maybe there's a way we can help each other. Let's make a deal. You help me convince my parents I'm already spending plenty of time in nature, so they stop sending me fracking camping all the time, and I'll give you $20.
You want me to lie to your parents?
Patricia wasn't sure if that was the sort of thing an honorable witch would do.
Yes, he said. I want you to lie to my parents.
$30, okay? That's pretty much my entire supercomputer fund.
Let me think about it, Patricia said.
This was a major ethical dilemma. Not just the lying, but also the part where she would be keeping Lawrence from an important experience his parents wanted him to have. She couldn't know what would happen. Maybe Lawrence would invent a new windmill that would power whole cities after observing the wings of dragonflies. She pictured Lawrence, years from now, accepting a Nobel Prize and saying he owed it all to the great outdoors adventure weekends. On the other hand, maybe Lawrence would go on one of those weekends, fall into a waterfall, and drown. And it would be partly Patricia's fault. Plus, she could use $30. Meanwhile, Patricia kept trying to make other friends. Dorothy Glass was a gymnast, like Patricia's mom had been, and the mousy, freckled girl also wrote poetry on her phone when she thought nobody was looking. Patricia sat next to Dorothy at convocation when Mr. Dibbs, the vice principal, talked about the school's no scooters policy and explained why rote memorization was the best way to repair the short attention spans of kids who had been raised on Facebook and video games. The whole time, Patricia and Dorothy whispered about the webtoon everyone was watching, the one with the pipe-smoking horse. Patricia felt the stirring of hope. But then Dorothy sat with Macy Firestone and Carrie Danning at lunch and looked right past Patricia in the hallway afterward. And so Patricia marched up to Lawrence as he waited for the bus.
"You're on," she said. "I'll be your alibi."
Lawrence really was building a supercomputer in his locked bedroom closet, behind a protective layer of action figures and paperbacks. The computer was cobbled together from tons of parts, including the GPUs from a dozen PQ game consoles, which had sported the most advanced vector graphics and complex narrative branching of any system ever during the 3 months they were on the market. He'd also snuck into the offices of a defunct game developer two towns over and rescued some hard drives, a few motherboards, and some assorted routers. The result was bursting out of its metal corrugated rack space, LEDs blazing behind piles of junk. Lawrence showed all of this to Patricia while explaining his theories about neural networks, heuristic contextual mapping, and rules of interaction, and reminding her that she had promised to tell nobody about this. At dinner with Lawrence's parents, super garlicky pasta, Patricia talked a good game about how she and Lawrence had gone rock climbing, and they had even seen a fox up close. She almost said the fox ate out of Lawrence's hand, but she didn't want to oversell. Lawrence's parents were overjoyed and startled to hear how many trees Lawrence had been up. Neither of them looked like they'd hiked in years, but they had some hang-up about Lawrence spending too much time sitting at his computer instead of filling his lungs.
"So glad Lawrence has a friend," said his mom, who wore cat glasses and had her curls dyed an obscene shade of red.
Lawrence's dad,
who was morose and bald, except for one brown tuft, nodded and offered Patricia more garlic bread with both hands. Lawrence's family lived in a dingy subdivision in an ugly cul-de-sac, and all the furniture and appliances were old. You could see through the carpet to the cinder floor. Patricia and Lawrence started spending time together, even when she wasn't vouching for his outdoorsiness. They sat next to each other on the bus, on a field trip to the Cannery Museum, which was a whole facility devoted to cans. And every time they hung out, Lawrence showed her another weird device. Like, he had built a ray gun that would make you sleepy if he aimed it at you for half an hour. He hid it under the table at school and tested it on Mr. Knight, the social studies teacher, who did start yawning right before the bell. One day in English class, Ms. Dodd asked Patricia to get up and talk about William Saroyan. No, wait, just recite William Saroyan from memory. She stumbled over the gravel road of words about the insects who live in fruit until she noticed a light shining in her eye, blinding her, but only on the right side. With her left eye, she saw the wall of bored faces, drawing not enough entertainment at her discomfort. And then she found the source of the dazzling blue-green beam. Lawrence had something in his hand, like a pointer. I have a headache, Patricia said. She was excused. In the hallway, during passing period, she yanked Lawrence away from the drinking fountain and demanded to know what the hell that had been. "Retinal teleprompter!" Lawrence gasped, looking actually scared of her. Nobody had ever been scared of Patricia. "Still not quite perfected. If it had worked, it would have projected the words directly onto your eye." Patricia felt actually scandalized at this. "Oh, but isn't that cheating?" "Yes. Because memorizing the speeches of Rutherford B. Hayes will prepare you for life as an adult." Lawrence rolled his eyes and walked away. Lawrence wasn't sitting around feeling sorry for himself. He was making things. She had never met anyone like him before. And meanwhile, what could Patricia do with her so-called magic powers? Nothing. She was totally useless. Chapter 4. Lawrence's parents decided Patricia was his girlfriend, and they wouldn't hear reason. They kept offering to chaperone the two kids to school dances or to drive them to and from dates. They wouldn't shut up about it. Lawrence wanted to shrink to nothing. "Here's the thing about dating at your age." Lawrence's mom sat facing him as he ate breakfast. His dad had already gone to work. "It doesn't count. It's just like practice, training wheels. You know this isn't going to amount to anything, but that doesn't mean it's not important." She was wearing sweatpants with a blouse. "Thanks for your input, Mom. I appreciate all of your keen insights." "You always make fun of your poor mother." She swept her hands in opposite waves. "But you ought to listen. Puppy love is when you learn game, or you never do. You're already a nerd, honey. You just don't want to be a nerd with no dating skills. So I'm just saying, you shouldn't let your thoughts about the future keep you from making the most of your middle school fling. Listen to one who knows." Lawrence's mom had gone to her fifth-choice grad school instead of her first choice, to be closer to his dad, and that had been the first of many compromises that had ended them up here. "She's not my girlfriend, Mom. She's just someone who's teaching me to appreciate tick bites." "Well, maybe you should do something about that. She seemed like a very sweet girl, very well brought up. She had nice hair." "I would make a move if I were you." Lawrence felt so uncomfortable in this conversation. Not just his skin was crawling, his bones, his ligaments, his blood vessels were crawling, too. He felt pinned to his stiff wooden chair. At last he understood what all those old horror stories meant when they talked about an eldritch dread creeping into your very soul. That was how Lawrence felt, listening to his mother attempt to talk to him about girls. Even worse was when Lawrence heard the other kids at school whispering about him and Patricia. When Lawrence was in the locker room before P.E., kids who normally paid zero attention to him, jocks like Blaze Donovan, started asking him if he'd gotten her shirt off yet, and offering him make-out advice that sounded like it came from the Internet. Lawrence kept his head down and tuned them out. He couldn't believe he'd lost his time machine just when he needed it most. One day, Lawrence and Patricia were sitting adjacent to each other at lunch. Not with each other, just adjacent to each other, at the same long table where boys mostly sat at one end and girls at the other. Lawrence leaned over and asked, "People think we're, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend. Doesn't that kind of weird you out?" He tried to sound as though he thought it was no big deal, but he was just expressing concern about Patricia's feelings. Patricia just shrugged. "I guess people are always going to have something, right?" She was this weird, fidgety girl with eyes that looked brown sometimes and green sometimes, and dark, straight hair that never defrizzed. Lawrence didn't really need to hang out with Patricia at school, because he only needed her to vouch for his after-school time, and maybe weekends. But he felt awkward sitting by himself when she was also sitting by herself, usually frowning out the nearest window. And he found himself curious to ask her stuff and see how she responded, because he never, ever knew what Patricia would say about anything. He only knew it would be something weird. Lawrence and Patricia sat under the up escalator at the mall. They each had a double chocolate, ultra-creamy, super-whip frosticino with decaf coffee in it, which made them feel super grown up. They were lulled by the machinery working right over their heads, the wheel of steps going around forever, and they had a view of the big fountain, which made a friendly splashing noise. Soon, both their drinks were nothing but throaty, snorty noises as they took the last pulls on their straws, and they were both blitzed on sugar. They could see the feet and ankles of people passing on the down escalator between them and the fountain. They took turns trying to guess who these people were, based just on their footwear. "That lady in the white sneakers is an acrobat, and a spy," Patricia said. "She travels around the world doing performances and planting cameras in top-secret buildings. She can sneak in anywhere because she's a contortionist as well as an acrobat." A man in cowboy boots and black jeans came past, and Lawrence said this was a rodeo champion who had been challenged to a Dance Dance Revolution showdown against the world's best breakdancer, and it was happening at this very mall. A girl in UGG boots was a supermodel who had stolen the secret formula for hair so shiny it brainwashed anyone who saw it, said Patricia, and she was hiding at the mall, where nobody would ever expect a supermodel to go. Lawrence thought the two women in smart pumps and nylons were life coaches who were coaching each other, creating an endless feedback loop. The man in black slippers and worn gray socks was an assassin, said Patricia, a member of a secret society of trained killers who stalked their prey, looking for the perfect moment to strike and kill undetected.
"It's amazing how much you can tell about people from their feet," said Patricia. "Shoes tell the whole story."
"Except us," said Lawrence. "Our shoes are totally boring. You can't tell anything about us."
"That's because our parents pick out our shoes," said Patricia. "Just wait until we're grown up. Our shoes will be insane."
In fact, Patricia had been correct about the man in the gray socks and black shoes. His name was Theodolphus Rose, and he was a member of the Nameless Order of Assassins. He had learned 873 ways to murder someone without leaving even a whisper of evidence, and he'd had to kill 419 people to reach the number 9 spot in the NOA hierarchy. He would have been very annoyed to learn that his shoes had given him away, because he prided himself on blending with his surroundings. His was the gait of a mountain lion stalking the undergrowth, clad in the most nondescript black slippers and mountaineer socks. The rest of his outfit was designed to fade into the background, from the dark jacket to the cargo pants with their bulky pockets stuffed with weapons and supplies. He kept his bony, close-shaved head down, but every one of his senses was primed. His mind ran countless battle scenarios, so that if any of the housewives, mall-walking seniors, or teenagers attacked without warning, Theodolphus would be ready. Theodolphus had come to this mall looking for two special children, because he needed a pro bono hit to keep up his standing in the Nameless Order. To that end, he had made a pilgrimage to the Assassin Shrine in Albania, where he'd fasted, inhaled vapors, and gone 9 days without sleep. And then he'd stared into the ornately carved seeing hole in the floor of the shrine, and he'd seen a vision of things to come that still replayed in his nightmares. Death and chaos, engines of destruction, whole cities crumbling, and a plague of madness. And at the last, a war between magic and science that would leave the world in ashes. At the center of all this were a man and a woman, who were still children now. His eyes had bled as he'd crawled away from the seeing hole, his palms scraped away and his knees unhinged. The Nameless Order had recently imposed a strict ban on killing minors, but Theodolphus knew this mission to be holy. Theodolphus had lost his prey. This was the first time he had ever been inside a mall, and he was finding the environment overwhelming with all of the blaring window displays and the confusing letter number code on the giant map. For all Theodolphus knew, Lawrence and Patricia had spotted him somehow, gotten wind of his plans, and laid an ambush. The housewares store was full of knives that moved on their own. The lingerie store had a cryptic warning about the miracle lift. He didn't even know where to look. Theodolphus wasn't going to lose his cool over this. He was a panther, or maybe a cheetah, some type of lethal cat, anyway. And he was just toying with these stupid children. Every assassin has moments when he or she feels the grip slipping, as though the cliff face is spinning away and a sheer drop beckons. They had talked about this very issue at the assassin convention a few months earlier, that thing where even as you pass unseen through the shadows, you fear everybody is secretly watching and laughing at you. "Breathe, panther," Theodolphus told himself. "Breathe." He went into the men's room at the Cheesecake Factory and meditated. But someone kept pounding on the door, asking if he was about done in there. There was nothing for it but to eat a large chocolate brownie sundae. When it arrived at his table, Theodolphus stared at it. How did he know it wasn't poisoned? If he really was being watched, someone could have slipped any of a dozen substances into his sundae that would be odorless and flavorless, or even chocolate-flavored. Theodolphus began to sob, without making any sound. He wept like a silent jungle cat. Then at last, he decided that life wouldn't be worth living if he couldn't eat ice cream from time to time without worrying it was poisoned, and he began to eat. Lawrence's father came and picked up Lawrence and Patricia, half a mile from the mall, right around the time that Theodolphus was clutching his throat and keeling over. The ice cream had indeed been poisoned. And Patricia did what she mostly did when she talked to Lawrence's parents. Make stuff up. And we went rock climbing the other day, and whitewater rafting, although the water was more brown than white. And we went to a goat farm and chased the goats until we tired them out, which, let me tell you, is hard. Goats have energy, Patricia told Lawrence's father. Lawrence's father asked several goat questions, which the kids answered with total solemnity. Theodolphus wound up banned from the Cheesecake Factory for life. That tends to happen when you thrash around and foam at the mouth in a public place while groping in the crotch of your cargo pants for something, which you then swallow in a single gulp. When the antidote kicked in and Theodolphus could breathe again, he saw his napkin had the sigil of the Nameless Order on it, with an ornate mark that more or less said, "Hey, Remember, we don't kill kids anymore. Okay?
This was going to require a change of tactic. Chapter 5. Whenever she could, Patricia escaped to the heart of the forest. The birds laughed at her attempts to mimic them. She kicked a tree. Nothing responded. She ran deeper into the forest. "Hello? I'm here. What do you want from me? Hello?" She would have given anything to be able to transform herself, or anything else, so her world wasn't just boring walls and boring dirt. A real witch ought to be able to do magic by instinct. She ought to be able to make mystical things happen by sheer will or with a profound enough belief. A few weeks after the start of school, the frustration became too much. Patricia grabbed some dried-up spices and twigs from the basement of the spice house, went into the woods, and lit them on fire with kitchen matches. She ran around and around the tiny flame inside a shallow pit, doing nonsense chants and shaking her hands. She pulled her own hair and threw it into the flames. "Please," she choked through tears. "Hello? Please do something. Please." Nothing. She crouched on her heels, watching her failed enchantment turn to ash. When Patricia got home, her sister, Roberta, was showing their parents camera phone pictures of Patricia lighting a fire and dancing around it. Plus, Roberta had a headless squirrel inside a food pile bag, which she claimed was Patricia's work. "Patricia is doing satanic rituals in the woods," said Roberta. "And drugs. I saw her doing drugs, too. There were shrooms. And 420. And Molly."
"Pee-pee, we're worried about you," Patricia's father said, shaking his head until his beard was a blur.
Pee-pee was his nickname for Patricia when she was a little baby, and when they were about to punish her, he would start using it again. She thought it was cute when she was little, but when she got older, she decided it was a subtle reference to her failure to be a boy.
"We keep hoping you're going to start growing up. We don't enjoy punishing you, Pee-pee, but we have to prepare you for a tough world where..." "What Roderick is saying is that we spent a lot of money to send you to a school with uniforms and discipline and a curriculum that creates winners,"
Patricia's mom hissed, her jaw and penciled eyebrows looking sharper than usual.
"Are you determined to blow this last chance? If you just want to be garbage, just let us know, and you can go back to the woods. Just never come back to this house. You can go live in the woods forever. We could save a large sum of money."
"We just want to see you become something, Pee-pee," her dad chimed in.
So they grounded her indefinitely and forbade her to go into the woods ever again. This time, instead of sliding food under her door, they kept sending Roberta up with a tray. Roberta put Tabasco and Sriracha chili oil on everything, no matter what. The first night, Patricia's mouth was burning, and she couldn't even leave her room for a glass of water. She was lonely and cold, and her parents had taken all of the stuff from her room that might entertain her, including her laptop. In her total boredom, she memorized some extra passages from her history book, and she did all of the math problems, even the extra credit ones. The next day at school, everybody had seen the pictures of Patricia dancing around the fire and of the squirrel with no head, because Roberta had sent them to her friends at high school, and some of Roberta's friends had brothers and sisters who went to Canterbury. More people started giving Patricia weird looks in the hallway, and this one boy, whose name Patricia didn't even know, ran up to her during lunch recess, yelled, "Emo bitch!" and ran away. Carrie Danning and Macy Firestone, the theater kids, made a big show of checking Patricia's wrists, because she was probably a cutter, too, and they were concerned.
"We just want to make sure you're getting the help you need," Macy Firestone said, bright orange hair rippling around her heart-shaped face. The actual popular kids, like Tracy Burt, just shook their heads and texted each other.
The second night of being grounded, Patricia started to go nuts, and she was choking on the red-hot, super-spicy turkey and mashed potatoes Roberta had carried up.
She was coughing and rasping and wheezing. The sound of the television downstairs, too loud to ignore, too quiet to make out what anyone was saying, peeled her skull. The weekend was the worst part of being grounded. Patricia's parents put their own weekend plans on hold so they could keep her locked in her room. Like they had to miss an exhibition of vintage door knockers that they'd read about in one of their design magazines, which they'd been looking forward to. If Patricia could do magic, then she could fly out her window or communicate with witches in China and Mexico. But no, she was still just boring and bored. Sunday came around. Patricia's mother made a pot roast. Roberta poured Tabasco over Patricia's portion before bringing it upstairs. Roberta unlocked the door and handed the tray to Patricia, then stood there in the doorway to watch Patricia eat, waiting to see Patricia freak out and turn bright pink. Instead, Patricia calmly loaded a big forkful into her mouth, chewed, and swallowed. She shrugged.
"It's too bland," she said. "I would prefer it to be spicier."
Then she handed it back to Roberta and closed her door. Roberta took the tray back down and found a bottle of Texas Extra Spicy 5-Alarm Barbecue Sauce. She splashed it onto Patricia's pot roast until it gave off a pungent aroma. She carried the food back up to Patricia and handed it over. Patricia chewed a bit. She said.
"A little better, but still not spicy enough. I would really like something a lot spicier."
Roberta went and got a jar of Peruvian hot pepper seeds and dotted them all over the pot roast. Patricia felt as though her mouth was on fire after just one bite, but she forced a smile onto her face.
"I would still like it spicier, thank you,"
Patricia said. Roberta found some chili powder on the top shelf of the downstairs pantry and put a generous scoopful onto Patricia's dinner. She had to pull her sweater over her nose and mouth to carry it back upstairs. Patricia considered this screaming piece of beef, which was way spicier than the spiciest thing she'd ever eaten, a 5-alarm chili that had been billed as forbidden by the Geneva Cooking Convention, by the roadside diner where her family had stopped last summer. She forced herself to take a big bite and chew slowly.
"Sure, that'll do. Thanks."
Roberta watched Patricia eat the whole thing, slowly, but like she was savoring it, not like she was in pain or reluctant. When it was all gone, Patricia thanked Roberta again. The door closed, and Patricia was alone. She let out a fiery gasp. Patricia's stomach was being eaten from the inside. Her head was boiling away, and she felt faint. Everything was blinding white, and her mouth was a toxic disaster area. She was sweating red-hot oil through every inch of her skin. Most of all, her forehead hurt from pushing against the ceiling. Wait a second. Why was her forehead up against the ceiling? Patricia could look down and see her own body flopping around a bit. She was flying. She had left her body. Something about so much chili powder and hot oil all at once must have put her into a state. She was astral projecting, or something. She no longer even felt her stomach pain or any tingling in her mouth. That was for her physical body.
"I love spicy food," Patricia said with no mouth and no breath.
She flew to the woods. She raced over the lawns and driveways, swooping and lifting, amazed at the feeling of the wind pressing through her face. Her hands and feet were pure silver. She rose higher, so the highway was a stream of brightness underneath her. The night felt cold, but not in a painful way, more like she was filling up with air. Somehow Patricia knew the way to the place where the Parliament had met when she was a little girl. She wondered if she was dreaming all this, but it had too many funny details, like the highway construction closing one lane in the middle of the night. Who would dream that up? And it all seemed totally real. Soon she was in front of the majestic tree where the Parliament had met.
its great wings of leaves arching over her. But there were no birds this time. The tree just fanned in the darkness, the wind animating its fronds a little bit. Patricia had wasted a trip out of her body because nobody was home. Just her luck. She almost turned and flew back. But maybe the birds were in recess somewhere nearby. "Hello?" Patricia said into the darkness.
"Hell," a voice said back. "Oh."
Patricia had been standing, planted in a patch of ground, but at the sound of that voice she jumped and rose 4 feet in the air because she still weighed nothing. She remembered at last how to come back down to earth. "Hello?" Patricia said again. "Who's there?"
"You called out," said the voice. "I answered."
This time, Patricia could tell somehow that the voice was coming from the tree itself, like there was a presence there, at the center of its big trunk. There wasn't a face or anything, just a feeling that something was watching her.
"Thank you," Patricia said.
She was getting cold, after all, in her panda pajamas. She was barefoot outdoors in the autumn night, even though this wasn't her body.
"I have not spoken to a living person," the tree said, forming the words syllable by syllable, "in many seasons. You were distressed. What is wrong?"
Its voice sounded like the wind blowing through an old bellows, or the lowest note playing on a big wooden recorder. Now Patricia felt embarrassed, because suddenly her problems felt tiny and selfish when she placed them in front of such a huge and ancient presence.
"I feel like a fake witch," she said. "I can't do anything at all. My friend Lawrence can build supercomputers and time machines and ray guns. He can make cool things happen any time he wants. I can't make anything cool happen."
"Something cool," the tree said in a gust of vowels and a clatter of consonants, "is happening right now."
"Yes," Patricia said, ashamed again. "Yes, definitely. This is great. Really. But this just happened on its own. I can't make anything happen when I want it to."
"Your friend would control nature," said the tree, rustling through each syllable one by one. "A witch must serve nature."
"But," Patricia said, thinking this through, "that's not fair. If nature serves Lawrence and I serve nature, then it's like I'm serving Lawrence. I like Lawrence, I guess, but I don't want to be his servant."
"Control," the tree said, "is an illusion."
"Okay," Patricia said, "so I guess I really am a witch, right? I mean, you called me a witch just now. Plus I left my body. That counts for something. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I know it must be hard work being a tree, especially a parliamentary tree."
"I am many trees," the tree said, "and many other things besides. Goodbye."
The journey back to Patricia's house went much faster than the outward trip, perhaps because she was much sleepier. She passed through the ceiling of her bedroom and into her body, which was twisted with horrible stomach pain, because she had eaten enough hot peppers for 100,000 curries.
"Ah!"
Patricia shouted, sitting up and clutching her stomach.
"Bathroom break! Bathroom break! I need a bathroom break now!"
On Monday, she sat across from Lawrence at lunch at the far end of one of the long tables, next to the slop cans, where the kids who had no clique of their own were stuck.
"Can you keep a secret?"
she asked him.
Sure, Lawrence said without hesitating. He was poking holes in his gray, clammy hamburger with a knife. You already know all of my secrets.
Great.
Patricia lowered her voice and covered her mouth.
So listen, you probably won't even believe any of this. I know it's going to sound crazy, but I have to tell someone. You're the only one I can tell.
She told the whole story, as best she could. Chapter 6. Every time Lawrence showed Patricia another one of his inventions, he felt a crick in his neck. Sort of a Charlie horse that only happened when he pulled an experimental device out of his knapsack. He wondered about this for days until he realized he was instinctively flinching away from Patricia and lifting one shoulder, braced for her to call him a creep. "Here's something I've been working on," he would start to say, and then his neck would spasm. Even when he realized he was doing it, he couldn't stop. Like part of him always flashed back to his sixth-grade show-and-tell disaster, the laser scoop. But if anything, Patricia just seemed endlessly curious. Even when he showed her the remote-controlled cyborg cockroach kit he'd ordered from the Internet one day after school. "Here's where you connect it to the roach's central nervous system, so it will obey all of your fiendish commands," Lawrence said, pointing at the little wires on the tiny metal wedge, fresh out of the box. A truck belched underneath the pedestrian overpass they were sitting on, so neither of them could talk until it had passed. "Roachborg." Patricia looked at the roach saddle in Lawrence's palm. "That is nuts." She started to do a Borg voice from Star Trek.
"Doritos are irrelevant."
"So you're not grossed out?" Lawrence put it back in the box it came in, and the box back in the knapsack. He looked at her, still kind of giggling, though with a nervy edge to it. A car pulled a boat down the road, probably the last chance for sailing this year. Patricia considered this. "Sure, it's kind of yuck, but not as bad as when we dissected a cow brain in biology class. I just don't feel sorry for a roach." Her legs kicked against the metal underside of the bridge, through the slats in the railing. Right now, as far as Lawrence's parents knew, he and Patricia were halfway up the Crystal Lake Trail. They both just watched the cars for a moment. Patricia had taken to rolling up the sleeves of her uniform cardigan all the time, so people could tell at a glance that she wasn't cutting herself. She really wasn't, okay? "Just remember," Patricia said in a suddenly grown-up voice, "control is an illusion." He could see the unscathed veins in her bare forearm. He realized she was quoting the magic voice she'd talked to. "And yet," she went on, "I'm still jealous of your toys. You just never give up. You keep on making stuff. And whenever you show off something new to me, you have this look of joy on your face." "Joy?" Lawrence thought he had misheard for a moment. "I'm not joyful. I'm pissed off, all of the time. I'm a misanthrope." That was his new favorite word, and he had been waiting to use it in a sentence for a while. She shrugged. "Well, you look joyful. You get all excited. I envy that." Lawrence wondered if he could possibly cringe and be joyful at the same time. He rubbed his sore neck, first with one hand, then with both. For some reason, Lawrence believed Patricia's story about talking to some birds and having an out-of-body experience. He was still kind of a gullible person, which had made him easy to prank at summer camp, but also he rebelled at the idea of starting to close off possibilities in the world. If Patricia, who was sort of his friend, believed this stuff, then he wanted to support her. Also, she was suffering for her witchcraft, and it would offend some basic sense of fairness for Lawrence to think she was being punished for nothing. And really, was her story any crazier than other stuff? Like the way Lawrence's body seemed to be rolling out new, totally unrequested features with alarming speed? Not really. Plus, Patricia had become pretty much the only person Lawrence could talk to at school. Even the other so-called geeks at Canterbury Academy were too chicken shit to hang with Lawrence, especially after he'd managed to get himself banned from the school's computer lab. He wasn't trying to hack anything, just make some improvements. And the school workshop. He was doing a carefully controlled flamethrower experiment. She was the only one he could laugh with about the Serenian program's weird test questions. Faith is to religion as love is to blank. And he liked how she people-watched in the cafeteria, how her gaze turned Casey Hamilton's student council campaign into an amusing pageant taking place on the outskirts of Fairytown. Patricia pulled her legs out of the railing and got to her feet. "But you're lucky," she said. "There's a difference between your type of outcast and mine. If you're a science geek, people give you wedgies and don't invite you to their parties. But if you're a witch, everybody just assumes you're an evil psycho. It's kind of different." "Don't try and lecture me about my life." Lawrence had gotten to his feet as well, and now he dropped his rucksack on the ground so it nearly tumbled off the overpass. He felt both sides of his neck tighten up. "Just don't. You don't know what my life is like." "Sorry." Patricia bit her lip, just as a tanker rolled underfoot. "I guess that was out of line. Just trying to warn you that if you're going to be my friend, you have to be prepared for worse stuff than just people thinking we're girlfriend-boyfriend. Like, you might get some of my witch cooties on you." Lawrence rolled his eyes at this. "I think I can handle a little peer pressure." Brad Chomner gave Lawrence a dumpster swirly after fifth period a few days later. Lawrence looked up, head soaked with slime, rusty walls tearing at his uniform shirt, and Brad was grabbing Lawrence by the lapels and hauling him up so they were almost face to face. Brad Chomner's neck was thicker than Lawrence's whole torso. Worse yet, when Brad let Lawrence fall to the cement walkway, he saw that his indelible forever crush, Dorothy Glass, had been watching the whole thing. "I don't know if I can take 4 more years of this place," Lawrence told Patricia when the two of them were sitting at one end of the lunch table, uncomfortably close to the garbage cans, so soon after his trash baptism. His head still itched. "I keep thinking maybe I could transfer to the math and science high school in town instead." "I don't know," Patricia said. "You'd have to get up early every day and take the bus alone. You'd be spending so much time on the bus, you'd probably miss out on all the after-school stuff." "Anything's better than this," Lawrence said. "Mr. Gluckman, the math teacher, already wrote a letter for me. Now I just have to get my parents to sign the form. I have a feeling they're going to be weird about me going to school so far away, though." "They just want you to have a real childhood. They don't want you to grow up too fast." "They worry about me too much. Ever since I ran away from home this one time to go see a rocket, they just don't want me to stand out." While Lawrence was talking, a tater tot hit him in the head, but he just kept talking as if nothing had happened. "I think it's good that you have parents who care what becomes of you." Patricia seemed to have a soft spot for Lawrence's parents, maybe because they weren't scary overachievers like hers were. "My parents are cowards. They're always terrified someone will notice them, and they'll have to explain themselves." A second tater tot impact. Lawrence barely flinched. Lunch was almost over, and then they had separate classes. Lawrence changed the subject. "Hey, do you want to talk to my supercomputer?" He was gathering up all his stuff into his book bag. "I think it needs more interaction with different people, to help it learn how humans think."
"What would I talk to it about?" Patricia said.
"Just whatever you want," Lawrence said. "Think of it as a friend to confide in." He pulled a scrap of yellow-lined paper out of his bag. "This is the computer's IM account, on all the main services. Its name is ChangeMe." He spelled that. CH@NG3M3. "It's a temporary name, just like it sounds. When ChangeMe becomes fully sentient and starts thinking for itself, it can choose a new name. But I like that name.
It's like I'm challenging the computer to grow and change and find an identity for itself.
Or maybe you're asking the computer to change you, Patricia said.
Yeah. Lawrence looked at his own handwriting on the notepaper.
Yeah, maybe I am at that.
Okay, Patricia said. I'll try talking to it. She took the paper from Lawrence and stuffed it into her skirt pocket.
Anything you tell change me will be between you two, Lawrence said. I won't ever read any of it.
Speaking of which, Patricia said, I hear the new guidance counselor is actually pretty okay. Maybe you should go talk to him about your Brad Chandler problem.
The bell rang, and they ran their separate ways.
Lawrence decided to take Patricia's advice, since he'd heard other people say that the new guidance counselor was cool. He'd only recently taken over after the previous school counselor got run over by a meat truck. The new guy did have an easy talk show host vibe about him, as he told Lawrence that he could share anything inside his boxy office with its anti-drug posters and bookcases instead of a window. Theodolphus Rhodes was a tall man with a shaved head, no eyebrows even, and grotesque knobby cheekbones and chin.
I just, Lawrence said, the bullying, it is interfering with my ability to achieve academically. When I get locked in a dumpster, it causes me to miss social studies class, which is going to drag my grades down. I am not an escape artist.
If Lawrence didn't know better, he would think Mr. Rose was studying him, like a bug. Then the moment passed, and Mr. Rose looked friendly and supportive again.
It seems to me, the guidance counselor said, that the other children see you as an easy target, because you're so noticeable and yet so defenseless. You have two options in this situation, to make them respect you or to become invisible, or some combination of the two.
So, Lawrence said, stop standing out so much? Stop eating lunch in the cafeteria? Build a death ray?
I would never advocate violence.
Mr. Rose leaned back in his pleather chair with his hands behind his smooth head.
You children are too important. You are the future, after all.
But find ways to make them see what you're capable of, so they respect you. Keep alert and always know your escape routes. Or try to blend into the shadows as much as possible. They can't hurt what they can't see.
Okay, Lawrence said. I sort of see what you're saying.
Children, said Theodolphus Rose, are adults who haven't yet learned to make fear their hand puppet. He smiled.
Chapter 7. A bullfrog jumped out of Patricia's locker. A big one. Too large to cup in your hands. It croaked, probably something like, "Get me out of here." Its eyes looked strangulated with panic, and its legs, awfully little, to support such a bulbous frame, twitched. It wanted to find its cool, wet nest and get away from this white hell. Patricia tried to catch it, but it slipped through her grasp. Someone must have spent hours catching this thing, gotten up at dawn or something. The frog gave a vengeful grunt and took off down the hallway, heading God knew where, as all the kids shrieked with laughter.
"Emo bitch!"
someone called out. After school, Patricia sat on her bed and talked to Change Me, Lawrence's supercomputer, like she did every day lately. "My parents say they'll never let me go into the woods as long as I live, which means I'm no use to anybody at all. And everybody at school keeps accusing me of being a cutter and a crazy person. Sometimes I wish I was crazy. It would make everything easier."
"If you were crazy,"
Change Me responded,
"how would you know you were crazy?"
"That's a good question," Patricia admitted. "You would need to have one person who you completely trusted. Like,
If you trusted one other person, you could check to see if you were seeing the same things they were. She chewed her thumb, sitting cross-legged on her brass kettle quilt, legs tucked under her skirt.
What if you didn't see the same things?
Change me, said.
Would you be crazy?
Sometimes, when the computer got out of its depth, it would rephrase Patricia's answers back to her and change them slightly, which almost looked like it was thinking, but not quite. You're lucky you don't have eyes or a body, Patricia told it. You don't have to worry about any of this stuff.
What do I have to worry about?
Change me asked, in another blue speech balloon. Getting unplugged, I guess. Lawrence changing his mind and turning you off.
Where would you get another pair of eyes?
Change me abruptly dragged the conversation back to the earlier topic, something that happened when it judged they reached a dead end.
What kind of eyes would you want to have?
Something about this conversation gave Patricia an idea. If her parents wouldn't let her go back to the woods, maybe she could get them to agree to something else. Like, maybe she could get a cat. At dinner, Patricia forked steamed kale around her plate while her mom asked what everybody had done to improve themselves today. Roberta, the perfect straight-A student, always had the best improvements. Like, every day she'd aced some crazy tough assignment. But Patricia was stuck at a school where all you ever did was memorize stuff and fill out multiple-choice ovals, so she had to lie, or else learn something in her spare time. For 3 or 4 days in a row, Patricia kept coming up with improvements that sounded kind of impressive, storing up credit. And then she started mentioning that she wanted to get a cat. Patricia's parents disliked animals and felt certain that they would be allergic. But at last, they relented. So long as Patricia promised to do all cat-related labor, and if the cat got sick, they wouldn't have to rush to a vet or anything. We have to agree in advance that all veterinary care will be scheduled far ahead, in a time window that's convenient for Roderick and myself, said Patricia's mother. There will be no such thing as a cat-related emergency. Are we in agreement? Patricia nodded and crossed her heart. Berkeley was a fluffy black kitten with a huge white stripe on his stomach and a white smudge across his scowly face. Patricia named him after a cartoonist. They got Berkeley already fixed, out of a litter of kittens from their neighbor, Mrs. Torkelford, and right away Patricia noticed something familiar about him. He kept giving Patricia the stink eye and running away from her, and after a few days she realized he must be the grandson, or grandnephew, of Tommington, the cat she'd stranded up a tree when she was little. Berkeley never spoke to her, of course, but she couldn't shake the impression that he had heard about her. Also, even though Roberta had expressed no interest in getting a cat beforehand, she wanted to share Berkeley. She would hoist Berkeley by his little shoulders and carry him up to her bedroom, then close the door. Patricia would hear a pitiful groaning, even over Roberta's loud music, but the door was locked. And the one time Patricia told her parents she thought Roberta was mistreating the cat, they referred back to the no cat-related emergencies clause. All Roberta would say was, "I'm teaching him to play the bongos." Patricia wanted to protect Berkeley from her sister, but he hissed if Patricia even came close. "Come on," Patricia kept pleading in her human voice. "You have to let me help you. I don't want anything from you. I just want to keep you safe." But the cat fled whenever Patricia approached. He'd taken to hiding in a million nooks and crawl spaces in the spice house, emerging when his bowl was full or he needed the litter box. Roberta had an uncanny ability to know when Berkeley was out, and astounding reflexes for scooping him up. Another day, another improvement. After lights out, Patricia heard yowls that started high and got lower and more tragic, coming from Roberta's room.
The next day, after school, Lawrence came over to Patricia's house, where he'd gotten used to the musty aromas of old seasonings. The two of them sat in the front parlor, where you could still see the outlines on the wall.